That takes the pressure off. I want to start by acknowledging that we are in the traditional territory of the Coast Salish peoples, and I want to acknowledge with gratitude the presence of Tom Spear, a direct descendant of Chief Seattle of the Duwamish tribe. We're honored by your presence. I want to thank all the amazing people at Town Hall. It's so fantastic to be back in this very special place, space, and all of the different groups you've already heard them thanked who have co-sponsored this evening, and my friend and colleague, Casey Golden, who I love serving with on the 350 Board of Directors and have been inspired by his strategic thinking, and he, in fact, has two of the best quotes in This Changes Everything, but I won't give them away now. But they have to do with the power of resistance in this region, the deep love of place that is behind so many tremendous victories out of the Pacific Northwest. I want to start by reading a very short section from the introduction to the book. I don't usually do this kind of thing, but I'm going to do it tonight. So this is how the book starts. What gets me most are not the scary scientific studies about melting glaciers, the ones I used to avoid. It's the books I read to my two-year-old. Looking for a Moose is one of his favorites. It's about a bunch of kids that really, really want to see a moose. They search high and low, through a forest, a swamp, in brambly bushes, and up a mountain for a long-legged, bulgy-nosed, branchy-antlered moose. Now, the joke is that there is a moose hiding on every single page of this book, but the kids don't see it. And at the end of the book, all the moose come out of hiding, and the kids proclaim, "We've never, ever, ever, ever seen so many moose." And this is the refrain, "Have you ever seen a moose? Have you ever seen a moose?" Now, on about the 75th reading, it suddenly hit me. He might never see a moose. And I tried to hold it together. I went back to my computer and began to write about my time in northern Alberta, tar sands country, where members of the Beaver Lake Cree Nation told me about how the moose had changed. One woman described killing a moose on a hunting trip, only to find that the flesh had turned green. I heard a lot about strange tumors, too, which locals assume had to do with animals drinking water contaminated by tar sands toxins. Mostly, I just heard about how the moose were simply gone, and not just in Alberta. Rapid climate change turns Northwoods into moose graveyard, reads a May 2012 headline in Scientific American. A year and a half later, the New York Times was reporting that one of Minnesota's two moose populations had declined from 4,000 in the 1990s to just 100 today. Will he ever see a moose? Then the other day, I was slain by a miniature board book called Snuggle Wuggle. It involves different animals cuddling, with each posture given a ridiculously silly name. How does a bat hug, it asks. Topsy-turvy, topsy-turvy. For some reason, my son reliably cracks up at this page. I explain that topsy-turvy means upside down because that's the way bats sleep. But all I could think about was the report of some 100,000 dead and dying bats raining down from the sky in the midst of record-breaking heat across Queensland, Australia, whole colonies devastated. Will he ever see a bat? I knew I was in trouble the other day when I found myself bargaining with starfish. Red and purple ones are ubiquitous on the rocky coast of British Columbia, where my parents live and where my son was born and where I have spent about half of my adult life. They're always the biggest kid pleasers because you can gently pick one up and give it a really good look. "This is the best day of my life," my 7-year-old niece Miriam, visiting from Chicago, proclaimed after a long afternoon spent in the tide pools. But in the fall of 2013, stories began to appear about a strange wasting disease that was causing starfish along the Pacific coast to die by the tens of thousands. Termed the sea star wasting syndrome, multiple species were disintegrating alive, their vibrant bodies melting into distorted globs with legs falling off and bodies caving in. Scientists were mystified. As I read these stories, I caught myself praying for the invertebrates to hang in for just one more year, long enough for my son to be amazed by them. Then I doubted myself. Maybe it's better if he never sees a starfish at all. Certainly not like this. When fear like that used to creep through my armor of climate change denial, I would do my utmost to stuff it away, change the channel, click past it. Now I try to feel it. It seems to me that I owe it to my son, just as we owe it to ourselves and to one another. But what should we do with this fear that comes from living on a planet that is dying, made less alive every day? First, accept that it won't go away, that it is a fully rational response to an unbearable reality. Next, use it. Fear is a survival response. Fear makes us run. It makes us leap. It can make us act superhuman. But we need somewhere to run to. Without that, the fear is only paralyzing. So the real trick, the only hope, really, is to allow the terror of an unlivable future to be balanced and soothed by the prospect of building something much better than many of us had previously dared hope. Yes, there will be things that we will lose, luxuries some of us will have to give up, whole industries that will disappear. And it's too late to stop climate change from coming. It's already here, and increasingly brutal disasters are headed our way no matter what we do. But it's not too late to avert the worst. And there is still time to change ourselves so that we are far less brutal to one another when those disasters strike. And that, it seems to me, is worth a great deal. Because the thing about a crisis this big, this all-encompassing, is that it changes everything. It changes what we can do, what we can hope for, what we can demand from ourselves and our leaders. It means there is a whole lot of stuff we have been told is inevitable that simply cannot stand. And it means that a whole lot of stuff we've been told is impossible has to start happening right away. Can we pull it off? All I know is that nothing is inevitable. Nothing except that climate change changes everything. And for a very brief time, the nature of that change is still up to us. So, that concludes the reading part of this evening. So, the reason I chose this title is not because I think my book will change everything, but because I think climate change changes everything, and I think that that's a good place to start the discussion. And when choosing a title, it's good to choose a title that starts the discussion where you think it should start, because a lot of interviews begin with, why is your book called that? And the reason why it's a good place to start the discussion is because it's important for us to understand that we have procrastinated for so long that there are now no non-radical solutions left on the table. So if we stay on the road we're on, we face radical changes to our physical world. This is what the vast majority of climate scientists tell us, and now what some of our most conservative state institutions are telling us. The World Bank, the International Energy Agency, PricewaterhouseCoopers tell us that if we stay on the road we are on, we are headed towards warming of between 4 and 6 degrees centigrade. That's 10.7 Fahrenheit on the high end. That is incompatible with anything that we might call organized, civilized society. All the models break down, really, after 3 degrees. I mean, the scientists tell us they don't know what this would look like beyond the fact that it would be radical change. It would be whole huge cities underwater, whole countries disappeared. It would be massive crop failure, and possibly much worse. All we have to do to arrive at this scary place is nothing. All we have to do is not react as if this is an existential crisis. This is known as business as usual. Being us, only more so, because that's what we do. We grow more and more and emit more and more every year. So that's one radical scenario on the table. Another radical scenario that I discuss in the book is what's increasingly being taken seriously among the very serious people, and that is intervening in the climate system through radical technologies at a global scale, sometimes called geoengineering, to try to make those outcomes less disastrous, potentially making them more disastrous. We don't know. You can't find out before you do it because you can't build a model of the climate system to scale. I spent a fair bit of time hanging out with the would-be geoengineers, the smartest guys in the room who are talking about fertilizing the oceans, pumping sulfur into the stratosphere, solving the problem of pollution with more pollution. That's pretty radical, dimming the sun. Now, the good news is that it's not too late to prevent these radical physical and engineering scenarios. But the way we do that at this point involves radical changes to our political and economic system. These are certainly considered radical, at least by current political standards. They involve questioning and really breaking, as I'll argue, every rule in the free market playbook to which our leaders are still in thrall. Now, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about the need to challenge this so-called free market ideology, because I feel like we can spend a lot of time talking about various solutions, cap and trade versus cap and dividend, and we lose sight of the fact that actually, you know, none of it's happening, right? Certainly not at a national level, certainly not at a level that will get us anywhere near where we need to go. And that has to do with the ideology that has swept our world. So the argument I make about why we have failed so miserably to rise to this challenge, I mean, and the fact that we've failed is now beyond debate. Since our government started meeting in 1990 to come up with a plan to reduce emissions, global emissions have gone up by 61%. So that is not a good record. And there are all kinds of theories that have been put forward to explain this inaction. We sometimes hear that it's just human nature, that this crisis seems too far off and that we're hardwired to respond only to immediate threats. But this, this rationale doesn't really ring true anymore because, of course, climate change is looking more and more like an immediate threat. It certainly looked like an immediate threat when Superstorm Sandy flooded Wall Street. Not that Wall Street has changed its behavior in any way. So there's something else. And we know that we humans have responded to abstract threats before, when our immediate safety was not threatened. We have this in our history. So then it must be something about us. And I think a lot of us believe this, that it's our generation that is too selfish. So this is one of the rationales. The other rationale is just that it's too complicated, right? That you have to get all of these countries to come together and agree on a set of rules, and it's just impossible. We hear this a lot. But of course, our governments have come together and they have agreed on all kinds of things, whether it was the Montreal Protocol, on ozone depletion, whether it's arms treaties. But what about the creation of the World Trade Organization? What about a global trade architecture with binding rules that our governments have managed to build in this very same period when they were failing to deal with the climate crisis? So clearly we can cooperate and come together if the interests are are aligned with those in power. So I think that, you know, there's little bits of truth in all of these rationales and some that I haven't mentioned, but I think that we haven't paid enough attention to one of the biggest obstacles to change, which is just bad timing, bad historical timing. And by this I mean that scientists have known about climate change for a long time, but the point where we lost all plausible deniability, we the public, was really 1988. That was the year that James Hansen testified on Capitol Hill that he now had a high degree of certainty that there was a connection between emissions and warming. That was the year, by then, 87% of Americans knew about global warming. And that year, when the editors of Time magazine needed to choose their man of the year, they decided not to give it to a man. They were still only giving it to men. But man of the year 1988 was Planet Earth, the planet in peril. And it was a really interesting essay that accompanied that cover story, which talked about how climate change really called into question the whole Western civilizational paradigm of dominance-based thinking, the idea of the Earth as a machine. It traced it back to Francis Bacon. It was this really interesting essay to read in Time magazine. You could never imagine it appearing today. And there was, you know, speaking to people who were involved in the movement at that time, there was actually really a feeling that this was the dawn of a new consciousness, this moment. And then the Berlin Wall collapsed the next year, 1989. This was the moment when Francis Fukuyama declared history over, when the ideology that in most parts of the world is called neoliberalism declared victory over all other economic models. And it was then exported around the world. 1988, the same year that Hansen testified, was the year that Canada and the U.S. signed the historic free trade agreement that was then expanded into NAFTA, became the paradigm used, the model for future bilateral and multilateral trade deals. A few years later, the World Trade Organization was formed. So you had these two parallel processes. Now, this was a problem. And it was a problem not just because the global economy, as it was being called, that was being created, was a particularly high emissions one, but because the ideology of neoliberalism had as its pillars privatization, deregulation, cuts to taxes paid for with cuts to social services, now called austerity, never-ending austerity, all locked in through this architecture of free trade or investor rights deals. Now, what I do in the book is show how each one of these pillars of this ideological project that so successfully spread around the world has stood in the way of what we need to do to respond decisively to the climate threat. And I'll just give you a few quick examples. I mean, a lot of this is obvious. Take austerity, right? I mean, the idea that, in my lifetime, all I have known of the public sphere is its dismantling. You know, my parents' generation built things. But since I have been a conscious adult, it has only been about stopping the cuts, stopping the attacks. We don't get to build things anymore. And, of course, this has reached catastrophic levels in this country, particularly in Europe, in the wake of the financial crisis, which has been passed on to the public. And you see the direct clashes because, of course, if we're going to respond to climate change, we need to invest seriously and on a large scale in not just protecting the public sphere but reinventing it along the lines that Casey was talking about. And we see the clash when disaster strikes. I mean, you see it in this country during Hurricane Katrina, that clash between heavy weather and weak, neglected infrastructure, a government that doesn't seem to be home, can't seem to find New Orleans. We saw it during Superstorm Sandy, where, you know, if you have these widely divergent experiences of a natural disaster, or not a natural disaster, but you know, if you have resources, you're kind of okay. But if you're in public housing that has been allowed to decay, the lights are out for weeks and weeks, no one shows up, and it was, you know, a bunch of, you know, 20-somethings from Occupy Sandy, as it was called, who were doing frontline work, which was, you know, amazing. And we did some filming of this makeshift health clinic that was started in the Rockaways, and it was incredible. I mean, it was just heroic work. But the people there were going, wait a minute, where is the government? You know, why are we doing this? There were historic floods in England this year, and it was really interesting to see the logic of austerity clash with what the public wanted in that moment, which was they wanted a forceful public response. Now, this was a problem for David Cameron, sort of Mr. Austerity himself, because he had slashed the agency responsible for flood response, knowing that increased flooding is clearly going to be one of the impacts of climate change in Britain. Nonetheless, he had laid off more than 1,000 people, canceled hundreds of flood defense programs, and people connected the dots. And he was so panicked in this moment. He had another 1,000 jobs were on the chopping block. And Cameron was so panicked that he had to publicly say, money is no object. We will spend whatever it takes, right? And that's just a glimpse of how, you know, if we take this crisis seriously, this logic of austerity cannot hold. You know, our governments have to find the money, and that means going to where the money is, which part of the response is going after the fossil fuel companies, polluter pays, we'll come back to that. But, you know, this is happening all over Europe. In Greece, the fire trucks don't have spare tires. Going into forest fires, I mean, Greece is a tinderbox. And this is how austerity is playing out in that country. At the same time, in the name of exiting austerity, Greece is being told that they need to drill for oil and gas in the Ionian and Aegean Seas, which is madness. Because you know, this is a country whose two major sectors are tourism and fisheries, right? So, you know, when I call the book Capitalism versus the Climate, people say, well, that's divisive, you know? But the thing is capitalism is already waging war on the climate. And so the point of this is, you know, I think that there are different levels of denial. You know, we talk a lot about this right-wing denial where it's really obvious and it's easy to laugh at the people at Fox News. But I think we all engage in our own versions of climate denial. And one of the reasons why we have to stop is that that if we look and let ourselves feel the depth of this crisis, we have some of the most powerful arguments we've ever had to argue for a saner economic system. I'll give you another example, free trade. Now, a lot of people in this room, I think, have been involved in these battles. How many of you were part of the Battle of Seattle 15 years ago? A couple? A few? Now, one of the things we're finding is that, you know, we knew when we were fighting the World Trade Organization that this was a system that sacrificed workers' rights and environmental rights in the name of short-term profits. But we did not know how right we were, because what's been happening in recent years is that some of the best climate policies are being successfully challenged in trade court. And I'll give you an example from close to home for me. I mentioned spending half my adult life in BC. The other half I spend in Ontario. And Ontario has had the most ambitious emission reduction program in North America. It was lauded by many people in this country, including Al Gore, for its extremely ambitious plans to get 100% off coal. This is Canada's most populous province by 2015. And the Green Energy Act was introduced in 2009 in the midst of the economic crisis. And it was introduced because of concern about climate change, but it was primarily introduced because of concerns about unemployment, because Ontario is an economy that is extremely reliant on manufacturing, and in particular, car manufacturing. And our auto sector was getting decimated by the fact that the big three automakers were on their knees at this point. And it was easier to close Canadian plants than to close American plants when you're going to the American government for a massive bailout, which is what was happening at that time. So there were huge numbers of layoffs in the manufacturing sector in Ontario. So very smartly, the Ontario Liberal government introduced this green energy plan that had these ambitious emission reduction targets, but also had very ambitious job creation targets, and required that any player, any company, but there were also non-companies, co-ops, and so on, communities that wanted to benefit from Ontario's new feed-in tariff program, had to manufacture 40 to 60% of their equipment in Ontario. So it was a job creation plan. It was about rebuilding our moribund manufacturing sector. And I profile this company in the book called Silfab, which was sort of like the poster child for how this was supposed to work, because it was it's a solar plant on the outskirts of Toronto that opened up in a closed-down auto parts factory. So it was the perfect symbol, like old economy dying, new economy opening. All these workers who had lost their jobs at Chrysler and Magna, which is a big auto parts manufacturer, got jobs on the assembly line making solar panels for this new program. And 31,000 manufacturing jobs were created. So all is going well. But then Japan and the European Union challenged Ontario's green energy plan at the World Trade Organization and argued that that requirement that a certain percentage of the jobs remain local was discrimination against their companies, against European companies and Japanese companies. And the WTO ruled in their favor, and Ontario lost. And rolled over very, very quickly, in fact, in part because the Canadian government wasn't about to fight for renewable energy when this is an extension of the oil and gas industry, as you may have noticed. But we're seeing more and more of these cases. This is not an isolated case. The U.S. has challenged China's renewable energy subsidies, India's renewable energy subsidies, and it's tremendously ironic because you go to, you listen in on a summit like the one that just happened in New York, and it's all about government sort of pointing the finger at each other. You're not doing enough. No, you're not doing enough. Oh, I won't lead. No, you lead, right? But in fact, what these governments are doing is running to the World Trade Organization and trying to knock down each other's windmills at precisely the moment when we need all of our governments to be rolling out the most ambitious plans they can, and to do it in a way that will get political buy-in, right? I mean, this was about a just transition. This was about supporting a sector that was getting hit hard and having a just transition to the new economy, and we were told that's not allowed. And in the book, I quote Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, who talks about how absurd it is that we are leaving the fate of the planet in the hands of what he calls silly lawyers who didn't even understand the issue when they wrote the rules. Nonetheless, it is happening. Now, the good news is we're facing a whole flurry of new deals, of new trade deals. That's not good news in and of itself. But the good news is I think we're starting to pay attention to trade again after tuning it out for a long time. A lot of us are very concerned about the new about TPP and the European deal and how it is undermining the actions that we need to take on climate. And I think that this, once again, is the best argument we have ever had against these deals. We cannot allow trade to trump the planet. It doesn't get much stronger argument than that, but that is precisely what these deals are doing. And we can't be afraid to use that argument. So another pillar of the neoliberal era, of course, is privatization. And I want to talk a little bit how this, the way in which so many of our cities, states, provinces have sold off key sectors that are central to the energy transition that we need to enact is standing in the way. Now, many of you have heard a lot about Germany's transition to renewable energy, which is a really It's a complicated case. You know, it's not all perfect, but nonetheless, it is definitely worth appreciating that a highly industrialized economy like Germany that does not have a lot of sun has managed in a decade and a half to go from 6% of its electricity coming from renewable energy to 25% coming from renewable energy, mostly wind and solar, most of it decentralized. So this is a real success story and one that shows that when we want to and the political will is there, we can move quickly, you know? And we need those success stories. One of the things we don't hear about the German transition is that one of the things that has allowed Germany to transition as quickly as it has is that in hundreds of cities and towns, big cities as well as small towns, citizens have voted and decided democratically to take back control over their electricity grids from the private players that privatized them in the 1990s. And they're doing this because they want to be part of this energy transition. They want their power to come from clean energy, and the private players are not willing to move fast enough. So they are deciding to take their energy back. But it's not only that; it's also that they want the money from the power generation to stay in the community. So it's both addressing the austerity crisis and climate change at the same time. The problem is not just that it's dirty energy. It's also that the money is just hemorrhaging from communities into shareholders' pockets, and that's not acceptable either. So it's become a pro-democracy movement, it's become an anti-austerity movement, and it's a climate movement. And these are the types of paradigms that we need, I think, to win. And it's also starting to spread. It's happening in this country, too. In the book, I tell this story about Boulder, Colorado, which is a fantastic example. You know, Boulder, this, you know, green city, very much like, you know, some of the cities in this region. And it had this problem, which is despite the fact that everyone biked and wore fleece, all of their energy was coming from coal, so they wanted to switch. They went to their local private energy provider, Xcel Energy, and talked about how they wanted to switch to renewable energy and were basically shut down. And at that point started exploring taking their power back, taking their energy back, not because they were ideologically opposed to privatization. It's because they wanted to be part of a green energy transition in line with their values, and the profit-driven interests of this company were standing in their way. They found that, and they took that step. And I think it is interesting that these aren't ideological movements. These aren't movements that are starting by saying we're anti-privatization. They're movements saying we want to do something about climate change, and discovering that they need to take on the logic of privatization in order to make that happen. There are other ways of bringing in green energy, and I think there are a lot of examples of that in this region. But there is clearly a tight correlation between very ambitious renewable energy targets and keeping energy in public hands. We see examples of that in this country, too, like Austin, Sacramento are two of the cities with the most ambitious emission reduction targets, and they never sold off their energy. So there's lots of public utilities that are producing dirty coal. But I think the point is that it's easier for us to change our public utilities than it is for us to change for-profit enterprises. So I said Germany is complicated. One of the reasons it's complicated is that while Angela Merkel has been willing to put in place some great incentives to encourage renewable energy, what she has not been willing to do is say no to the fossil fuel industry and coal. Is continuing actually to expand. And even though demand is dropping in Germany, the coal companies are just exporting that energy. Sound familiar? And so it's not a simple success story because, you know, sometimes we tell ourselves we can do this all with market mechanisms and having the right incentives in place, but it's clear that it has to be a combination of finding creative ways to say yes to what we want and bold ways of saying no to what we don't want. And part of part of what has us stuck right now is that we have a leadership class globally that has really lost the knack of saying no to big companies. When they're dangling big investment projects, it's just you automatically say yes. And you look at Obama and that it has taken him now more than 3 years to just say no to the Keystone XL pipeline. I'm starting to think he's going to leave office without just punting this decision. So the exciting thing is that with our leaders failing to lead, failing to do what they need to do, there is the emergence of what some have started to call blockadia, this grassroots regulatory structure, let's just say, of community. and it's been so powerful in this part of the world. I really do think that the fossil fuel industry did not know what they were in for when they decided to build so many tentacles through the Pacific Northwest. And this, in many ways, is the flip side of the carbon boom that we're in the midst of, because, of course, the fossil fuel companies are doubling down. They're building all kinds of new infrastructure. They're doubling down on some of the dirtiest carbon sources. They have to build all this infrastructure, and it takes them into territory that is distinctly hostile. And this, I used to say that the World Trade Organization built our coalitions for us. I mean, in many ways, the fossil fuel companies are building our coalitions for us by their sheer ambition of their coal trains and their oil trains and their pipelines and their LNG terminals and the rest of it. And that was what was so exciting about the climate march this past week, is you saw that network that is place-based really coming together in the streets. In common purpose. I'm running out of time, so I'm going to make some quick cuts here. In Canada, one of the most exciting parts of the emergence of this fossil fuel resistance, as our friend Bill McKibben calls it, is the way in which it is building really powerful ties between native, non-native, and native communities. Whenever there's a big resource battle, we see these connections, but there's something new happening. We saw this really clearly with the emergence of Idle No More, all these resistance movements, whether it's to the Cherry Point coal export terminal or the Northern Gateway pipeline through BC. I think what more and more of us are starting to understand is that Indigenous, First Nations, treaty rights, and Aboriginal title are the most powerful legal barrier to the plans to just flay this continent. And those rights become more powerful when there are mass movements defending them, and when they are embraced by whole societies. And this is really starting to change. And I think it's actually changing the way we think, as well as the way we fight. Because I think that it's about more than, and it has to be about more than just a sort of extractive relationship to those rights. Like, those rights are useful to us because they help us protect our water, so we want to use those rights. That's exactly the wrong way of thinking about this. That these are rights that come out of a vision of how to live well, that were hard won and hard protected, and they point us towards a non-extractive, regeneration-based way of living on this planet. And that is the most hopeful and exciting part of this new wave of activism. Now, like Casey was saying, this can sound overwhelming. Anything about climate change can sound overwhelming, and it's certainly easier to talk about changing light bulbs than changing the economy. But here's what we need to remember. It's not like we're talking about an economy that is working beautifully except for the small matter of rising sea levels. We're talking about allowing sea levels to rise in the name of protecting an economic system that is failing the vast majority of the people on this planet with or without climate change. By responding robustly to climate change, in line with what scientists are telling us, we have a once-in-a-century opportunity to solve some of our biggest and most intractable social and economic problems. We can create countless good unionized jobs in the next economy. Every dollar invested in renewable energy, efficiency, public transit creates 6 to 8 times as many jobs as that dollar would create if it went into oil and gas infrastructure. Those jobs can rebuild our ailing public infrastructure, and that infrastructure will give us more livable cities, stronger communities, healthier bodies. We all know this. We can find the money by making polluters pay, whether it's the fossil fuel companies or the bloated defense companies or the financial speculators. To do any of this, of course, we must dramatically reduce the power of corporate money in politics. Now, everybody who is trying to get anything done in this country that is in any way vaguely progressive, whether it's fighting private prisons or for gun control or universal health care, knows that money in politics is the single greatest barrier. The question that I'm left with is whether climate change can provide the big tent that we need to build a new kind of coalition and put us on a science-based deadline and tell us that we cannot afford to lose. I think it can, and I'll tell you why. The atmosphere is already our big tent. We are already under this big tent, and we have to start acting like it. We're coming up on the 15th anniversary of the Battle of Seattle, when the streets of the city were choked with tear gas and flooded with hope, because a mass coalition, a movement of movements, put the system of short-term corporate greed behind the World Trade Organization on trial. It disrupted the negotiations and emboldened internal dissent, and the talks broke down. They never quite recovered. But after September 11th, that movement broke apart. Some were spooked by the new war on dissent. Others turned their attention, understandably, to stopping war and increased criminalization. But we stopped talking about the system underneath it all. Then 3 years ago, this month, the Occupy movement sprung up and put corporate capitalism on trial once again. To draw the connections between the logic of deregulation and austerity and the inequality crises ravaging our communities, the whole world listened in. I firmly believe that movements like that never die. They just go quiet for a little while. They learn, they change, and reemerge. Now another movement is taking the stage, the climate justice movement. It's made up of all these past movements and many more older ones, deeper ones, the civil rights movement, the indigenous sovereignty movement, calling for the deep shift in worldview that we know this crisis is really about. Because underneath all of this is the truth that we've been avoiding. Climate change isn't an issue to add to the list of things to worry about next to health care and taxes. It's a civilizational wake-up call, a powerful message spoken in the language of fires, floods, droughts, and extinction, telling us that we need an entirely new economic model and a new way of sharing this planet, telling us that we need to evolve. Thank you.
About to start Q&A part of our event tonight. Before we do, I'd like to remind everyone to come up to the mics and speak into those as we are recording this tonight. Also, just Again, a reminder to keep your questions short and in the form of a question. We have only about 15 minutes for Q&A, so we'd like to get through as many questions as possible.
Let's start.
Well, if we want the good life for all 7 billion people on this planet, with sustainably grown food, sustainable use of precious raw materials, enough per capita wild spaces and rainforests, clean water, healthcare, and living space, what are your thoughts on the needs and benefits of voluntary population reduction? Do you think we can ignore that question?
I'm not sure what voluntary population reduction means. And I do think that I wouldn't say that population has nothing to do with the ecological crisis, but I think that we sometimes overplay it. Where population is growing fastest is in sub-Saharan Africa, and that is where emissions are lowest. If we want to deal with this crisis most effectively, we talk about consumption among the wealthiest people on the planet, not procreation among the poorest people on the planet.
This is just a quick question about the title of your book. I was a little bit puzzled when I heard the title because I had in my possession several copies of the book, This Changes Everything, that was created in collaboration with Yes Magazine about the story of the Occupy movement. And I was wondering if that had anything to do with your title.
I have an essay in that book, in This Changes Everything. So I realized it would create some confusion. There's actually a lot of books out there with the title This Changes Everything. I think there'll probably be more. When I thought of it for this title, it's not that it's such a great title. It's that I really think that it works with climate change in a particular way, in the way that I started about, just landing us where we need to land in terms of understanding that everything's going to change one way or the other. So realizing that other people had used the title and that I had an essay in a book with that and that some people might be confused about which book is which, you know, it might sell more of that book that Yes Magazine produced, which would be great. It's a great book.
And you did mention that the money and politics is sort of the base core of it all, and that's what Occupy was about.
Yeah, so. Well, it's all connected, absolutely.
Do you think climate change is the perfect topic to introduce a wider conversation about capitalism? I mean, in a sense, we have the equivalent of a right-wing climate denial might be, on the left, capitalism denial, the desire to use euphemisms like the free market or corporations without asking the kind of wider questions that connect to things like you say about how elections are funded and those other things.
I mean, I obviously agree with you because I called the book Capitalism versus the Climate. But I do think that there is this weird thing, and I've been feeling it particularly this week, like people really, like there's a larger constituency of liberals that really does not want to talk about capitalism than I anticipated. Like a lot of the criticism of the book has just been about the name.
Right.
One of the subtitles that the subtitle I almost went with is the revolutionary power of climate change. As you heard from the talk, like that's the argument I'm making. But I do think that this core tension between our economic model and what our climate needs from us, you know, that we have an economic model that is built on short-term expansion, and we need to contract our use of resources. We don't need to contract every part of our economy. We can grow other parts of our economy, and we need to grow other parts of our economy that are low carbon already, and that are going to the parts of the economy that are going to make this transition possible, but at the same time, we do need to contract. So I think we dance around. We really don't like saying the word capitalism, particularly in this country. But even, like, it's even easier to talk about growth than it is to talk about capitalism. And I actually think growth, focusing on growth, is less helpful than talking about capitalism, because I think in a lot of people's minds, when you're talking about capitalism, you are talking about greed. You're talking about corporate greed, and you get closer to that. Whereas if you talk about growth, then the first thing people think is that it's all going to be contraction and it's all going to be loss, and that's a very negative discussion to have. And it isn't true that it's all about contraction. It's really about how we manage our economy.
Well, and you did mention 1989, and it's a good point that before 1989, the fact that a lot of people in the world were talking negatively about capitalism meant that capitalism was ready to give more to people who weren't, who asked for things. So maybe if we start talking, we won't scare people away.
I'd just like to say I always enjoy these talks, but it sometimes feels like it's kind of preaching to the choir. And I just wanted to know what your thoughts are on disseminating all the information that you have that you presented tonight to people who mainly get their information from news outlets that it goes against their financial interest to report on all these topics. They might have corporate ties to fossil fuels, so they won't want to report on the climate march. They won't want to report on any of these issues, and will continue to maintain that status quo. So just how you think that this movement is best going to be spread out to beyond the people who already know about it.
I mean, I'm not... I feel like that is starting to happen. I mean, and some of it's happening in a more old-fashioned way. I mean, the climate march in New York was an extraordinary exercise in popular education, a really old-fashioned community organizing. I mean, it was an incredibly diverse march, did not look like the choir. It mobilized all kinds of communities that are normally left out of the environmental movement. And that was not done with the help of any corporate media. That was like really legwork, you know. And it was that hard, old-fashioned organizing work of building bridges across different constituencies, doing popular education, and I think we need to return to some of that, where, you know, like just teach-ins, just basic popular education. A lot of people don't participate in the climate discussion because it seems really, really wonky and they're afraid of making a mistake. You've got the science side, the policy side, the UN, like, you know, there's a whole bunch of, you know, worlds that have their own language and their own jargon. And so just unpacking it for people and creating context where they're not afraid to make a mistake is really important. But I don't know about that this is about going through corporate media at this stage. I mean, there is some of that, you know, like there was the Years of Living Dangerously and that kind of work. But I'm not sure that that's what builds a movement. I think the movement building is when people see the connections with their daily lives, and it comes from trusted sources. And I think we spend a lot of time sort of thinking about how we reach people who watch Fox News, you know? And we actually have a lot of work, I think more work, just building a broad, diverse, progressive movement, you know, and building bridges between the various constituencies in that world. And before we worry about, you know, reaching the climate deniers. I don't know if that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, that helps. Thank you. Yeah.
First, I was going to ask how it feels to be the most beautiful woman on the cover of Vogue of all time, but changing my mind, if you could send some advice to yourself back in time when you were first writing No Logo, what would you say?
Advice to myself?
Yeah. What do you wish you knew then that you know now?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I didn't really know anything then. I think one of the things that coming back to the last question about sort of preaching to the choir, I think one of the things that I've learned is just how nourishing it is to be in a movement. I think we kind of belittle it when we talk about it as just like preaching to the choir and, you know, as if this work doesn't matter. But when you're taking on really powerful forces, it can be pretty brutalizing. And if you're going to do it, you know, and if you're going to immerse yourselves in, you know, some of the worst of what humans are capable of, which anybody who's involved in social justice work is doing, you also need to counterbalance that by being in community and valuing that community and supporting each other.
I, by the way, am just a decoration in this conversation. We were going to have a little conversation at the beginning, and we want to save the time for all of you. So I'm glad I wore matching socks. Next question.
There was a moment of synchronicity for me today. I came up to hear my friend Helen Caldicott speak downstairs a little bit before, because my main issue regarding climate change, and has been for decades now, the nuclear movement, and I'm in the anti-nuclear movement. And one of the things that I found over time is, I do have a question for you too, but I just wanted to take a minute to explain this, that we okay, I'll go here. Okay. Not a problem. That the nuclear movement for me, or the anti-nuclear movement, has not really been brought up that much in the talks about climate change. And I just want to bring up that in nuclear power and nuclear weapons, which are one and the same, the question is this. We have mining with nuclear, we have uranium mining, we use coal for the spent fuel. And I just wanted to say that I find it important to include all of these things within talks and climate change, and thank you for all the work that you do.
I just have one question. Why aren't there more Naomi Kleins in the world?
Hi. I had a question about how do we sometimes get over the hypocrisy in fighting for a fossil fuel world when, you know, whatever, you can't really get away from fossil fuel. I mean, when you go to the grocery store and you go home to your polyester sheets and the plastic in everything that you buy. And, you know, even a lot of people who went to the climate protests, you know, flew there. And how do we get over this, like, kind of conflict within ourselves when we use fossil fuel every day and we don't want to, but you really can't get away from it?
It's a great question. I think it's tricky because, you know, Casey talked about, and I mentioned that in some ways, I think that we overemphasized, environmental movement overemphasized the individual actions at the expense of the big systemic changes that we need. And it was all about recycling and carbon offsetting and, you know, turning your personal life into like a low carbon piece of performance art. And a lot of it was like, no, but and a lot of it was quite sort of classist too, because in so there are so many communities that have no good transit options, where people are so overworked as well that people are having to make convenience-based decisions that are about low cost, but also about zero time, and this is what our culture does to people. And this idea that it's about being perfect and green and buying more green stuff, was super alienating to a lot of people. And I think was part of why it was the climate movement was so homogenous, meaning white and middle class. And but I think there's something really key. And I actually think it's that I don't think we should let ourselves off the hook. Like, we should all try to bring our actions in line with our values. But I also think that we should all embrace our inner hypocrites and stop playing gotcha. Because if you need to be pure, you know, if you need to be fossil free in order to fight fossil fuels, that's a great way of having a really small movement. You know? So.
Thank you for your speech and for being with us and all your inspiring work around the world. Here in Washington State, we have the fourth-ranking Republican climate denier in the House of Representatives, and we also have a Native American man running against her, and I've met him, and he's great. And I would like, my question is, how can your organization lead in inspiring voter registration across in all the places where we have too low of voter registration, and to teach America a new story about finding the right candidates to run for office and to win for office? Because the stories that we're told right now have to do with money, and here we have a situation where we have the right person running against somebody who needs to be out of office. Thank you.
Yay. More engagement on elections, especially right now, is absolutely vital. And I should say, I do work for a C3 organization, but it's Sunday night. I am not on the clock. And any political views I happen to express right now would be my own. That is a great race for folks to get involved in. There's also a huge, there's actually three or four really pivotal state Senate races right now on which the balance of the state Senate will probably hinge. I know the Washington State Labor Council, Jeff Johnson, is here and is organizing big voter turnout and doorbelling, and that's a just incredibly important thing we need to be doing in the short run. And nonprofit organizations can be doing exactly what you said, increasing voter engagement, increasing voter turnout, even without endorsing candidates. And that's a big part of how we win.
Thank you.
And I would just add that it's, you know, it's about getting involved in politics at every level, including at the local level, where maybe that it's a little bit easier to break through. And I would be remiss if I left Seattle without just saying how incredibly inspiring it was for everybody to watch the $15 minimum wage victory. you know. That kind of ambition is really contagious and inspiring, and, you know, all eyes were on you.
The Alberta tar sands are so destructive, but the cash flow is so overwhelming that there's no control possible. Do you have any good news about the Alberta tar sands?
Yes, I do. No, actually, I think the best piece of news we've had so far, which is Statoil this week, which is the big Norwegian oil company, huge player in the tar sands, announced the suspension of a multi-billion dollar tar sands investment because one of the reasons cited was uncertainty about pipeline capacity. And that is... that is the strategy of cutting off the arteries that we've all been involved in.
Uncertainty are us.
And this is the last question here.
As you've pointed out, the indigenous nations are making this region a choke point of fossil fuel shipping, but Swinomish and other tribes are also working with historically hostile local governments on climate change adaptation. And putting this book together with your last book about disaster capitalism, have you seen people preparing for these inevitable storms, disasters, power outages that are coming in a way to position community organizations in a place where we can instill disaster cooperativism and ways of bringing together communities and using that to also help build those bridges you're talking about?
That is a great, great question. And, you know, it certainly was a big part of the discussion post-Sandy that in New York of just that the communities that fared best were communities where people knew their neighbors, weren't afraid, you know, weren't, because there was a lot of fear too, where it was like all this fear of looting and just this understanding that this social fabric that we're able to build with one another, yes, seawalls are important, but relationships are even more important, checking in on one another, when communication systems break down, as they inevitably do, that we still know each other's names and where to find each other and knock on each other's doors and check in on each other. This has to be understood as part of disaster response. And so, yeah, I think we need a really broad understanding that responding to climate change isn't just about rebuilding the sort of public sphere in the sense of big state. It's about reclaiming the whole idea of the commons, of the public, of the communal, at every level, against the attack and the idea that we are nothing but atomized individuals and there's no such thing as society. I mean, these are that's another piece of the big war of ideas that we need to be fighting and also building. So, I mean, in that sense, you know, a farmer's market is disaster response, and anything we do to strengthen our communities and get to know one another and build those relationships of trust is part of preparing for the storms ahead. I realize that I didn't respond at all on the nuclear question, and I do think it is an important point on this, because it's important to remember that this vision of responding to climate change by building a more equal society is by no means the only way of responding to climate change. There is a shock doctrine scenario that is very clear, and that is, you know, not just the profiteering from disaster, but it's also, you know, the positioning of these big engineering fixes that continue to put communities at risk. So more and more, it's about talking about replacing fossil fuels with nuclear, positioning GMO crops as climate ready, climate smart, and attacking small farming as unrealistic and, you know, some agrarian fantasy, which is, you know, one of the ways I'm getting attacked at the moment. A few years down the road, it will be, you know, the geoengineering fix as more realistic than any of the stuff that we're talking about. So that's why I think it really is about identifying the values that we want to govern us as we move forward and together. Even more important than identifying individual policies is identifying those values. And one of the values that I think we need to, put at the front of our movements is that the people who have been on the front lines of our toxic extractive economy need to be first in line to benefit directly from the next economy. And I also think that, you know, Casey has talked and written about the no new carbon infrastructure, you know, drawing the line. This is the Keystone Principle. And I would say we need to extend that to the principle being no more sacrifice zones, that we know that we can power ourselves without sacrificial people and sacrificial places, right? And that, and I I think that that's really important to the nuclear discussions. Who are we asking to eat the risk for these technologies? And if it's not us, we have no right to ask it of anyone.
Yeah.